In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
I'd like you to think back to your high school years. You just get home from school when your mom calls. She says she left a $20 bill on the kitchen table and needs you to go to the store to buy some eggs, milk, and bread, because we're out of those. And says, while you're there, pick out some kind of side to have with the meatloaf she's planning on making. Before you leave, you check the cupboards and the refrigerator to see if anything else jumps out that maybe she didn't mention. Like, do we have enough cereal for tomorrow? Off you go to the store. You buy what's needed, except for that side she mentioned, because you saw a box of macaroni and cheese in the cupboard, and so you make an executive decision not to spend the entire $20 bill, even though those candy bars looked pretty tempting. In a nutshell, that's the constitutional relationship between Congress and the president. The Congress says, these are the things we need, and here's your budget. Now, if you listen to the shrieking Democrats who have convinced gullible seniors to take to the sidewalks on weekends holding their signs for their hands-off protests, their hands-off-our-fraud protests, they are demanding that Trump spend every last dime and then some. Shouldn't not spending every last dime and borrowing 10 trillion more dimes to spend be a good thing? You've got judges trying to force Trump to spend everything on what was clearly fraud, not to mention weighing in on his staffing decisions and inserting themselves into his authority to issue executive orders. I guess that's the Democrat version of democracy. But unelected judges acting as if they are president and overruling the duly elected president is a threat to democracy. It's funny how often Democrats are the threat to democracy they claim others are. To talk about that, I'd like to welcome back Hans von Spakovsky to the show. He is the manager of the Heritage Foundation's Election Law Reform Initiative and a senior legal fellow as well. Hans, it is great to talk to you again.
Well, thanks for having me. And listen, you get extra brownie points for actually pronouncing my name correctly.
It takes a while to get that. I have to practice
does,
that.
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. But anyway, you know, there's always a big advantage to having a name like Anderson. It's pretty hard to mess that one up. So anyway, you have some great articles on heritage.com, and we're going to link those up on iSpyRadio.com. This week's show is 15-20, so people can find those easily. And there's three of them in particular that deal with a judicial war that some judges are waging against not just Trump, but really against the Constitution. And I think that's the main issue here.
Right.
These judges acting outside the constitutional authority with these nationwide injunctions, and when they're not nationwide injunctions, they're blocking the executive branch from exercising its own authority over its own branch, not letting them cut spending, not letting them fire people, and even trying to stop them from making decisions about things like the military, which is clearly an executive branch decision. How is it that judges don't seem familiar with the Constitution, what powers the executive branch has, and the limits on their own authority?
Well, part of the problem is that the prior administrations of Barack Obama and Joe Biden, look, they nominated and got confirmed to the bench probably the most liberal, frankly, left-wing ideologues who have ever sat on the federal bench in the entire history of the United States. And many of them have great contempt for, frankly, the Constitution. Mm-hmm. And they don't recognize its limits. And oftentimes you can see in the decisions, the way they're written, that they're not basing their decisions on the law. They're basing them on their political views. And I can I give you a quick example of that?
Sure, sure.
Look, one of the cases, as you know, that came up was a federal judge telling USAID and the State Department that they had to pay out $2 billion
yes.
in grants that the State Department had suspended. And he put into his order, you have to pay out this money within 36 hours. Now, keep in mind that when Congress appropriates funding for the State Department to give out as foreign aid, they don't put a time limit on it. You know, they send a huge chunk of money, you know, many billions of dollars over to the State Department and basically tell the State Department, use this for foreign aid. And almost none of it is very specifically targeted. And it certainly doesn't have a deadline on it. So that judge was just making that up out of thin air, telling the department they had to pay it out with 36 hours when the original appropriation from Congress had no such time limit in it. Hmm. And that's an example of judges just thinking, well, you know, I'm God in my own courtroom and I can do whatever I want until and unless some court of appeals overturns me. And that gives you, if you're irresponsible, a lot of power.
Yes, it does. Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's just been shocking to see this. I mean, it really is an attack on the Constitution, the way that these judges are acting. And Thursday, the Supreme Court heard arguments about this notion that judges think they can overrule the president on executive/administrative decisions with these nationwide injunctions. I really liked Clarence Thomas's quip on that. We survived until the 1960s without universal injunctions. Was there a change in the law somehow that allowed that to suddenly start?
No, there wasn't. And in fact, and this was some of the points that were made in the arguments yesterday in the Supreme Court. And this was happened on Thursday, of course, May 15th, is that we've had literally hundreds of nationwide injunctions issued since the 1960s.
Yes.
They just didn't exist before. And as Thomas said, there wasn't any reason for it. And the big thing for people to understand is that these are coming not from the Supreme Court. They're not coming from courts of appeal. They're coming from the lowest level of the federal court system. These are federal district court judges. There are 93 federal districts across the country. And like, if you're a judge, if you're a federal judge, Georgia, for example, has two districts, the Northern and Southern districts. If you're a judge in the Northern District of Georgia, your jurisdiction is only the northern half of the state. That's it. It doesn't extend to the rest of the country. And it doesn't extend, for example, to Washington, D.C. And not only that, but look, these judges are violating a very basic precedent of the Supreme Court on this, which says, look, if you're going to issue an injunction, it can only affect the actual parties in your lawsuit. And again, the best example of that is that, look, a group of, I think, five pregnant women were among the individuals who sued Donald Trump over the birthright citizenship issue. Well, the judge in that case issues an injunction not against the government, not for those five pregnant women, but for like every pregnant woman in the country. They're not parties in the lawsuit. And that is a violation of Supreme Court precedent, says that their power is limited to the people who are actually in the lawsuit.
Yeah. It's shocking to see this overreach. And unfortunately, we're up against the clock. Let's take a break there. We'll continue this discussion about judicial overreach with Hans von Spakovsky of the Heritage Foundation. And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show. We're talking today to Hans von Spakovsky. He is the manager of the Heritage Foundation's Election Law Reform Initiative and a senior legal fellow there as well. He has some fantastic articles up on heritage.org, and we will link to that on today's show page, which is 15-20. Make it easy to find those. And so one of those articles is Trump's 100 Days in the Legal War in Washington, and we'll get to that in a moment. But I want to go back to the Supreme Court there that heard these oral arguments on Thursday about the judicial overreach. Right. Any thoughts on how they might rule? How did things go there?
Well, the biggest thing I think for people to understand, a lot of people were under the mistaken impression that the case before the Supreme Court was to rule on the issue of birthright citizenship. You know, what does the citizenship clause of the 14th Amendment mean? And is Trump right in his interpretation or the challenger's right? While that may have been the subject of the case, that was not what was before the court. What was before the court was the fact that the Trump administration was sued in three different courts None of them were filed in the District of Columbia, where the Capitol is located. They were filed in Maryland, Massachusetts, and Washington State. Now, why do people think those lawsuits were filed there? Because the plaintiffs were engaging in forum shopping. They wanted to get liberal judges, and they got them. And what the liberal judges in all three of those different areas did is they issued injunctions nationwide saying that the Trump administration could not enforce this against anyone in the country, not just the people who sued in the case. And what the Trump administration then did is they filed an emergency request with the U.S. Supreme Court to stay or suspend that injunction. But their request was very modest. They weren't even asking the court to totally suspend the injunction. They simply said the injunction should only apply to the actual people who are in the case and who sued, like the five pregnant women, not every single person in the country. So that's what the argument was about in the Supreme Court. And look, it was very clear to me that Sonia Sotomayor, Ketanji Brown Jackson, they are the most liberal members of the court, and they saw nothing wrong with any of this. They think nationwide injunctions are fine because they think the government is wrong on the substantive issues. So they're going to rule against Trump. Justice Kagan, who's also, you know, very liberal justice, she has complained in the past about nationwide injunctions. Remember, there were some issued against Joe Biden, for example. I think she didn't like the ones issued against Joe Biden. She likes the one issued against Trump. And I think she was looking for any reason to try to be able to distinguish the two so that she can write an opinion saying, well, it's okay to do this against Trump, but not against Biden.
It's funny that you bring that up because actually my very next question was, the problem is, you know, it's fine and dandy when it's your opposition in office and you can block them. But if injunctions are allowed to continue, it's setting precedent to allow Republican judges to do the same the next time there is a Democrat in office. I mean, don't the liberal justices see that?
Yeah, that is exactly right. But I think they just think they just look at it in the short term. I don't think they think of it in the long term. It's very clear, and you know this from past opinions, that some of the other justices have been very concerned about this. You know, you mentioned Clarence Thomas. Justice Alito has also talked about his concern over this. I could not tell from the questioning, though, how the court is going to come down. But the importance of this is that, look, the decision that they make, the rules they set out for the issuance of a nationwide injunction, isn't just going to affect this case, but it's going to affect dozens of other cases ongoing right now, because there have been more lawsuits filed against actions of this president in the first 3 months of his presidency than have ever been filed against any president in our entire history.
Yeah. I think it was 67 out of something like 127 or 64, I think, actually.
Yeah.
So if the judges are setting this precedent where they can overrule the other two branches, can the other two branches overrule the judiciary? I mean, it seems fair is fair, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, for example, people need to remember that if you look at Article 3 of the Constitution, that's for the judiciary, it only establishes one court. The U.S. Supreme Court, all of the other federal courts, the courts of appeal, these district courts where this is happening, those are all created by Congress by law. And what does that mean? It means that Congress could do everything from eliminate and get rid of those courts and particular judgeships to limiting their jurisdiction. I mean, if they, for example, wanted to pass a law that I'm not suggesting they do this, but if they want to pass a law saying, federal courts will have absolutely no authority to hear any case involving any immigration issue, Congress could do that. And there is nothing that anyone could do to prevent that. So Congress has enormous power over those courts, and the president, separate branch, co-equal branch, it's up to him to decide whether he believes that the interpretation of the Constitution that a court is issuing is correct or not. There's nothing that in the Constitution that requires a president to abide by what the judicial branch says. Now, they've always done that, as you and I both know. Well, with some exceptions. Remember Joe Biden in the last administration when he said that he wasn't going to abide by the Supreme Court's decision saying that he didn't have the authority to forgive all student loan debt. That's the first time I can remember that ever happening. A president saying, I'm going to defy the Supreme Court.
Yeah, well, I'm genuinely surprised that the judges haven't just cut to the chase and issue a nationwide injunction against the 2024 election, declare it null and void, and then they can declare themselves president. Okay, let's go ahead and take a break there. We'll pick this up with Hans von Spakovsky of Heritage Foundation. Stay with us. Hans von Spakovsky is the manager of the Heritage Foundation's Election Law Reform Initiative and a senior legal fellow there as well. Heritage does great work fighting for and defending America's heritage and conservative founding values and rights, and I encourage you to go visit them at heritage.org, and we'll link up some of Hans's articles on today's show page 15-20 on iSpyRadio.com. And so just to pick up something from that last segment there, you had said that there's nothing in the Constitution that requires the president to abide by these judicial rulings. So why have they?
Well, I think it's just been generally part of the idea that we want a stable government. And so prior presidents have conceded to the Supreme Court the ability to, you know, interpret what the Constitution says. But those concessions were based on having judges in office who were not ideologues,
right?
You know, and who were correctly and properly trying to interpret and apply the Constitution. And look, you have a lot of judges now, unfortunately, in the federal courts who are defying statutory law and defying the Constitution, and like I said, acting as if they are kings in their courtroom. Yes. Who can do anything that they want.
Yeah.
And that's a real problem.
Well, but just not kings in their own courtroom. They act as if they're kings in other kingdoms as well. That's right. I think is pretty
right.
Problematic there.
You made a joke at the last segment about a judge just declaring the 2024 election invalid and taking over for Trump. I don't know if you saw this, but a while ago, the Babylon Bee, you know, which does great satires,
yes,
had a headline saying Donald Trump resigns as president to become a more powerful federal judge.
I did see that. I probably shouldn't have said that on air because that'll give some judge some ideas there. So go figure. One of your articles that you have up there is Trump's 100 days in the legal war in Washington. And in that you say perhaps these judges would like to rewrite President Lincoln's Gettysburg Address to say that we must preserve government of the judges, by the judges, for the judges. So if they do not have the authority that they are claiming, I'm surprised that they've been allowed to exercise it. Doesn't this really come down to a Congress not doing anything to rein them in?
Well, there's two things that need to be done here. One of them is the Supreme Court needs to finally quit sitting on its hands and step in. You know, the Supreme Court has the ability to reverse these lower court judges, frankly, to be very critical of them, and to basically set out very definite rules on when nationwide injunctions are justified and not justified, and then enforce it. I mean, and so far, the Supreme Court hasn't done that. They have a chance to do it in the case they just heard on birthright citizenship, because that's what that issue is about. Congress can do something about this, too. You know, the House of Representatives actually already has. They passed a bill with almost uniform Democratic opposition just recently that said that changed the system for challenging, for example, executive orders by the president. And in order to prevent the kind of judge shopping that has been going on, this bill, if it became law, would require that any lawsuit challenging, for example, an executive order, would have to be assigned to three judges, not one.
Hmm.
Not only that, but an appeal would go directly to the U.S. Supreme Court, bypassing the courts of appeal, so that we would get very fast resolution of these cases. And with three judges, it would be much tougher for plaintiffs and other organizations to go shopping around to find one liberal judge who they know is going to rule their way.
Right.
Now, can that get through the Senate? Unfortunately, I'm afraid Democrats are going to filibuster it, but the House has already acted to try to help fix this problem.
Well, I'm sure that if it does pass the Senate, some judge will immediately issue an injunction to stop that. So, getting back to the notion of Congress doing something to rein in the courts, is there any precedent to do so, and have they done that in the past?
Well, I know there's been talk of potential impeachment.
I don't see that going anywhere.
Yeah, that's not going to go anywhere. I'll tell you just one historical example. Particularly, remember, with impeachment, you know, you have to have an impeachment in the House. You then have to have a trial in the Senate. It takes much greater than a majority vote to find somebody guilty. But, you know, Thomas Jefferson faced a problem like this. A lot of people forget that when John Adams and the Federalists realized that Jefferson was going to be elected president, they passed a Judiciary Act that created 16 new federal judgeships. And right before he left office, John Adams filled every one of those posts. The Federalists confirmed him in the Senate. And to the great frustration of Thomas Jefferson when he came into office, and when they took over the Senate and Congress, what did they do? They repealed that law and repealed all those new judges' positions. So they got rid of them without having to impeach them.
Hmm. We only got about a minute here with you. So real quick, you've got another article up there. Court upholds majority of Trump's executive order on election integrity. And within that, you talk about how the judge is trying to say that this is a bipartisan commission created by Congress, and therefore the president has no constitutional or statutory authority to direct its affairs. How many independent agencies are there that have zero oversight from the executive branch?
Oh, my gosh. I can't even count them all up. The Federal Election Commission, the Election Assistance Commission, the one that was the subject of this lawsuit, the Security Exchange Commission, the Federal I mean, it's just one commission after another like that. And the lack of authority that a president has over those agencies, that is a real constitutional problem. And that's another issue that is being challenged by Donald Trump, which is a good thing.
Yeah.
And that eventually is also going to get to the Supreme Court. And I think what may happen, what people are hoping happens, is that the Supreme Court will overturn a very bad precedent that they issued back in 1935 that gave Congress the green light to set up these kind of independent agencies that didn't have supervision of the president. And there's been a lot of grumbling, actually, from the Supreme Court in several cases over the last couple of years that case was wrongly decided.
Well, it's just astounding. I mean, we could go on and on about this judicial interference, and pretty soon Congress is going to end up establishing its own independent presidential agency to act as president if this sort of thing continues. Hans, I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Sure, thanks for having me.
In 2023, Senate Republicans walked out of the building to deny quorum to stop, among other bills, HB 2002, a horrendous bill. It sacrificed the lives and futures of innocent children.
through expanded access to abortion without their parents' knowledge or permission, through giving them life-altering drugs and irreversible surgeries to children, again, without parental involvement. The bill stripped parents of their rights to raise children the way they saw fit and made the state the parents. Democrats love to call anyone who disagrees with them Nazis. Someone ought to tell the Democrats that the Nazis also wanted full control of children to squeeze parents out of the picture, to indoctrinate children and raise them as the Nazi state saw fit. But that walkout caused additional problems because Democrats in Oregon had taken it a step further by passing a ballot initiative that effectively killed a fundamental and long-time procedural means to protect minority views in the legislature, to deny quorum, a procedure Democrats themselves had used when they were in the minority. Armed with new powers from uneducated Democrat voters, the Senate leader, a Democrat, could decide whether Republican senators had an excused absence or not. Go beyond that, and they lost their ability to run again for the Senate, which, ironically, not only removed senators, but denied voters the Democrat right to vote for the person of their choice. So, when the Republicans fought that bill and walked out, they did so knowing they were sacrificing their offices. But protecting children and parents were more important than an elected office, as it should be, because government should always be about protecting rights, not stripping them away. Government should always be about protecting people, especially the most innocent, from those who would do them harm. And I'd like to welcome back one of those, quite frankly, heroic senators who put it all on the line, former Senator Dennis Linthicum. Dennis, it's great to talk to you again.
You bet. It's always fun to talk because I'm no longer a senator. It's been quite a while, but thanks for inviting me back on.
Sure, absolutely. So that walkout, was it worth it?
Yeah, in a way, it was worth it. First of all, it was worth it to protect kids and their families and moms and dads. And we actually didn't do enough. I never came back. I refused to come back and participate in this sham. You might find it interesting. Your listeners certainly will. I'm reading a book called The Berlin Wall by a gentleman, Frederick Taylor, and it was written, you know, a while ago. And in the Berlin Wall, chapter 3 is called We Must Make It Look Like Democracy. And the subtitle to the chapter is But We'll Hold All the Cards. Hmm. And this gentleman who he's not really a gentleman, he's just a bad actor on steroids, who was responsible for building the Berlin Wall, dividing East Berlin from West Berlin during the era of Stalin Khrushchev. He worked for Stalin, and he was responsible for how that entire division happened. And in chapter 3, they describe the story how he comes to the how in the world are they going to do this? We've got JFK in the White House, we've got Khrushchev, taking over the reins from Stalin, but Stalin had been trying to secure Russia's prominence in those what we call Western Russian states that were overrun during World War II, And he says, just specifically, we've got to make it look like a democracy, but we'll hold all the cards. Now, what's important about that is that's exactly the way Oregon runs. All of our committees on the Senate side are 5-member committees, 3 Democrats and 2 Republicans. So you know the score every day, 3-2. You know the score, rain or shine, doubleheader, night game, it doesn't matter, 3-2. I was on the ballot writing committee for the ballot title and the wordage that would be in the voter's pamphlet. 2 Republicans, 2 Democrats writing that language, and the Republicans, myself and another Republican, Bruce Gilley, wanted to have it say more than 10 days of quorum denial. And the Democrat leftists wanted it to say 10 days of unexcused absence. Now, what's keen about this is that would have changed the outcome of the ballot measure, certainly, but there's a adjudicator, the 5th person on the committee, is a governor-appointed Democrat judge. So this governor-appointed Democrat judge becomes number five. It looks like it's democracy. Oh, we're being fair about this, but nothing's fair. The Democrats have a single-party rule, and it's instigated in everything they do, and it's destroying the state of Oregon. We see this clearly.
Yeah, absolutely it is. And unfortunately, the most undemocratic party out there is the Democrats. So getting back to the fact that you were unable to run again, you and your wife, Diane, have effectively swapped roles. She got elected as a senator, and you're her legislative aide. What's it been like being in the building but not being the senator? Has it given you a different perspective on things?
Well, yeah, it's, I do a good job for Diane. Diane's doing great. She's a great voice. She's part of the Oregon Doge team that are doing those videos. And she, you know, the difference for me is I loved being upfront and sharing my opinions and my voice and strategizing on things we could do to improve the Republican standing within the public eye. Diane is more of a, she's been my helpmate. We've been married for 45 years. And so we think a lot alike. We act a lot alike. We know what each other's thinking, but we're entirely different personalities. She's a female personality. She's a nurturer. I'm more, you know, masculine in my presentation. And so it really is different because I'm now doing analytical work, and she's kind of the voice, but her voice is a soft voice and my voice was a strong voice. So for me, it's also hard. There's Rule 27 in the Oregon Senate that says you can't offend anybody. Rep Yunker read some of the trash coming out of our library books, yes, and other representatives brought him up on Rule 27. He offended them, and microaggression type stuff. And now he's going to have a hearing about this, and he offended them. And how will they, you know, punish him or sanction him or do whatever they're going to do? It's just bizarre. So you need a silent space, some square footage for the Democrat majority to hang out in so that they don't get hassled.
Since they rule everything there, they kind of have their own safe space. And of course, what that means is they are they're effectively the emperors there within that building. Okay, let's go and take a break there. Everyone stay with us. The May revenue forecast was not good. We'll talk about that and other self-inflicted wounds next with Dennis Lithcomb. And welcome back. We're talking today to former Senator Dennis Lithcomb. He is now the legislative aide for his wife after he was unable to run anymore thanks to the Democrats deciding democracy really wasn't important and voters should not have the right to vote for the people that they would like to. So I went out of that break there talking about the May forecast there, revenue forecast that did not look good. But before we get there, the Democrats had lost their supermajorities in both the House and Senate. Have you seen any change in attitude since that happened?
Well, it's back. Rep Neron became Senator Neron Missler, and she is now occupying the seat that Senator Woods occupied before he passed away. So in the Senate, that's all. Their supermajority is back, and they'll have no problem marching to the governor's orders.
So as far as that May revenue forecast is concerned, it boiled down to blaming Republicans, which is weird because Democrats have had a supermajority in the House and Senate. They have a Democrat governor. They control all of the statewide offices. They control the entire judiciary with over 30 years of judicial appointments by Democrats. They literally have a one-party rule here in Oregon, but somehow the May revenue is forecast is Republicans' fault. Can you explain that?
No, because it's nonsense. It's sheer nonsense. They have been subsidizing and rewarding unions. That we had the Remember, unions planned Measure 113. Unions funded the Measure 113. Unions essentially through 10 conservative Republicans, myself being only one of six from last session, and there's four more that will get thrown out after this two-year cycle. You know, it's because senators are split across a four-year term. Half of them during this two-year term, right. Half of them during that for a four-year period. But 10 conservative Republicans all wiped off the ballot, wiped off the face of the earth because of this union backing. So Governor Kotek and the Democrats have been rewarding unions all session long. And the trouble is subsidies don't have a good track. Subsidies are spoils of war, and the money gets wasted. It goes through nonprofits. It goes through organizations. There's no accountability. There's no auditing of a nonprofit. That's why Elon Musk and the Doge at the federal level was so outlandish, as we're seeing $1 billion here and $1 billion there, and nobody knew it,
right?
Because it's a sound good organization that got funded.
Yes. Well, and USA, there was a guy in USAID who had formed his own NGO or nonprofit, I think, and then was literally writing checks to himself.
Yeah. And we don't know. That's probably happening in Oregon NGOs. They're getting money. They send a handful of it back to keep the governor in office and to sponsor the next leftist that they want in the Senate or House. And meanwhile, they never do the job they're going to do. Some of the jobs, like around housing, it's things like generate access to housing. And how do you generate access to housing?
Well, we certainly know it's not by harvesting timber. That certainly is not on the table. Just to move on, because we're already halfway through this segment, Democrats seem to be taxing everything in sight. And what they're not taxing, they're adding fees to. And what they can't tax or add fees to, they're adding regulations. Meanwhile, Trump just wrapped up his Middle East tour. According to a statement from the White House, it will bring in well over $10 trillion to the United States. With Oregon's unfriendly, toxic business environment, more regulations, higher taxes and fees, and high personal and business income taxes, how attractive will Oregon be to attract any of those trillions?
Well, hopefully they don't attract any of it, you know, and this may sound weird for me to say hopefully, but Oregon needs to wear this suit of armor. Oregon is so proud of their stance against Trump, not the common Oregonian, but the legislature, the legislative body, the Secretary of State, the AG. All of these statewide offices are all henchmen, whether it's ODOT or the DEQ, Department of Education, you name it. They are so proud of thumbing their nose at Trump that at some point they really do need a strong sanction to get them back in line. And I think that the good news is our upcoming election in 2-year cycle is a powerful moment in history. Remember, Trump won because he got the 7 swing states to swing to the other side. The pendulum is swinging. Right now, Governor Kotek is so far off the rails and so far out of touch and so far to the left of center of anything that we would consider normal in Oregon, that people are going to react and they're going to respond.
Well, I certainly hope so, because, you know, Oregon has set it up so that we're like the orphans standing on the street looking in at the restaurant where everybody else is having food and success. And meanwhile, we're on the outside. So I hope Oregonians will wake up to this. But on the same level, you've got Democrats literally willing to die on the hill for things like DEI and transgender. And so as a result, they're losing billions of dollars. Has there been any thought to losing all those billions in federal monies? I mean, have they done anything to plan for that? And has it occurred to any Democrat that maybe, just maybe, they should cut some spending?
Well, when you say have they planned for it, that's actually what all of the That's actually what all of the new taxes are. They're planning on taking that money out of your wallet and my wallet. They're not planning on generating that money through business technology or innovation. They're planning on generating that money by draining what's left yes. in the free economy. Yeah. And as they continue to suck money out of the private sector, they will fund it directly into their public sector for nonprofit for profit organizations, and Oregon will be an economic shell of what it has the potential to be.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate that Democrats would rather rule over the ashes than help Oregonians. There is no end of Oregon Democrats and their self-inflicted wounds. We'll wrap things up with Senator Dennis Lithcomb after this. And we're back in our final segment. Now we're wrapping up with former Senator Dennis Lithcomb from South Central Oregon, one of the more sensible parts of the state. After Democrats stopped democracy to prevent rebellious Republicans from running for office, his wife ran and took that seat over. And Dennis, we had talked earlier about the billions that Trump is looking at removing from Oregon thanks to these DEI and some of the other nonsense. In fact, somebody had just posted on X, they just got notice that two required trainings on discrimination and harassment and gender identity were coming. The discrimination harassment training says using the phrase "you guys" in a mixed gender group is considered microaggression and must be addressed by a supervisor at the moment it happens, and a follow-up with a one-to-one meeting of the offender. I mean, this kind of nonsense and the transgenderism, you know, where they are allowing boys to participate in girls' sports and all the rest. I mean, is that really the hill that Democrats want to die on?
Hopefully, because this will be victory for Republicans. I do this quite often. I'm of an age group where "you guys" is a common phrase for this group of individuals, whether they be, you know, I could be talking to a herd of cats and I'd say, "Come on, you guys, line up for me." And they wouldn't do it, of course. But to mention "you guys" when exiting the elevator, for example, "okay, we'll see you guys later," and leave the elevator. If all of those people in that elevator were offended and created a kersnaffle, you know, we would spend all of our time investigating the use of "you guys." And in truth, you could make up anything to pretend to be offended, which is what happens in the state of Oregon. Everybody is oppressed. And in the state of Oregon, every little issue becomes an oppression issue. And victimology is the key word of the day in Oregon. You can watch any committee meeting and people will exaggerate how hard they've been hit, how downtrodden they are, and how much they need the money out of your wallet. And that's what day in and day out we hear in the Oregon legislature.
We could probably do an entire show just on Oregon's own self-inflicted wounds there. You've got a situation where a recent audit showed that there's $1.8 billion of misspending, and then ODOT had a $1.9 billion audit that's, again, misspending. So potentially $3 billion are improperly accounted for. You've got up in Portland an infrastructure crisis of $1 billion a year. Well, first of all, those audits, is anything going to happen as a result of those?
No, the only way to get spending under control is to get the liberal mind fixed, because they have no ideas about how to run a business. They have no ideas about what practical economics looks like. They have no ideas about how to run a metro system and make it profitable, because what their idea of the metro system, and we heard this today in a meeting with Diane, one individual said Metro needs to start charging for passengers. And the Democrat responded, "But if we charge for passengers, it'll be a wash because we'll spend too much money collecting the money for every rider that's on Metro." And it's like, but wait a second, ding, 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 this ought to be a warning. If you're not going to collect the money because yes. you'll cost too much, never collecting the money to start with doesn't help this equation. And yet they don't see it. They just don't see it.
It's like no Democrat has ever run their own lemonade stand or something. I mean, it's just absurd to think that they have. I mean, you have to work to be that stupid when it comes to monetary policy. So secondly, you had mentioned earlier that Diane was part of the Oregon Doge team. Does that have any actual teeth or is it just investigative?
It's a talk show, video talk show. So they've got a real nice setup. They've got three microphones or sometimes four. They bring senators on and have a discussion and interaction and show slides. And they've created a whole bunch of 30-second and 1 minute slices of that podcast for creating memes. And the memes are getting pretty good traction. I don't know how many people are watching the full show. We could, of course, find that out for you if you wanted it. But the memes actually are nice, quick hits. They don't bore people. They make their point, and then they move on. And
we've only got a minute here with you. Real quick, what would it take to get a real Doge? You know, because on the federal level, that's happening under the executive branch through President Trump. Could, if Republicans retook the legislature, could they set up their own Doge team there? Or would it have to require governor authority?
Whether the governor signs it or not, it's a different question. Yeah. But we could do it. And it needs to be done. This is not something that's just a pipe dream out there. This needs to be done. The idea of auditing elections, the idea of auditing the books of organizations, the idea of keeping the money in state government instead of pawning it off through all these money laundering nonprofits is a step in the right direction because when it heads out to these NGOs, there is no auditing.
Yeah, and there needs to be some kind of oversight on that. Unfortunately, we're up against the clock, Dennis. I want to thank you so much for your time today.
You bet. Thank you so much. It's always a pleasure, and we'll do this again sometime.
Isn't it amazing how often the tolerant left is so offended at everything? Perhaps they should read the Constitution. The First Amendment guarantees your right to offend people. That's a hard concept for Democrats to understand because speech everyone agrees with doesn't need to be defended. Likewise, you cannot compel speech. That's already been decided by the Supreme Court. I keep waiting for someone here in Oregon to stand up to the DEI nonsense. If you're forced to go through DEI because you're white and made to feel bad about being white or any number of offenses if you're not male or not woke, sue them. You already have precedent with Supreme Court cases. And there are organizations like Southeastern Liberty and others that will help you sue. Kicking liberals in the groin has no effect for obvious anatomical reasons. So hit them in the wallet. That's what they fear. Remember, you get what you tolerate, because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.